So I expect you all done retreats and done meditation practices for a period of time, and all the ups and downs with that. And noticing that quite a lot of standard meditation practice involves getting to a particular point, focusing on a particular point or an object, getting the mind to settle down onto that object, stay with it, concentrate. That's quite a struggle, isn't it? I've never really been very good at that. But it's taken a number of years to actually acknowledge it. The mind's nature is one where it's continually roving and scanning and relating and referring, cross-referencing. You know, that's how it is, isn't it? It's not a lump, it's not a point, it's a field. Where there's fields of causes and effects, and that reminds me of that, and how's that, and the future, the past, and what would he think, and just that thing the mind is doing, and how we operate with that. We have to operate with that throughout the day. Yeah. Otherwise you wouldn't get very far. Then you're trying to, okay, now to get it down to one point, sit on one point. When you've been doing it, you know, exactly the opposite for many, many years, and will continue to do so. And then maybe you do get to kind of settle down onto one point, and then bing, bell goes, dong, 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 and then the whole thing, shooting match, opens up again. And you're doing that, you know. Yeah. And it's really helpful to just bearing that in mind and recognizing there's something about this. Just it helps you to see the kind of things that your mind gets stuck in, and it helps to level the energies out, and you just stay in your body, get focused, helps things to settle down a little. Informs you where you're getting stuck or where you're obsessive. And there's a realization that comes with that, helps to guide you to living more skillfully. In other words, you come from a point or a particular state that you may experience in meditation, which may be nothing that really wonderful, but it's a little bit deeper. You're not just skimming across the surface, you're actually, you know, getting into some depth. And from that, gives you some idea, some reflection, some feedback. It means you, as you come out of the meditation, you integrate, hey, that's ill will, I don't need that. You know, why don't I try to consider this other person another way? You're a bit more reflective. In other words, you come back to a level where you integrate into your life and you see the kind of things that have been causing you stress and agitation, the kind of things that you've been caught up in. You think, and you thought, wait a minute, I don't need to do this. Why don't I put this aside? And you come back to a level. And this is a process of moving from particular discrete states to levels. And levels means how you integrate, how you live your life. You live your life from a certain level, a certain ground, a certain set of values, assumptions, attitudes, intentions, and so forth. Yeah? And you start to see, well, probably the first realization, you know, for myself that came out of meditation was, I better start to be nice to myself. I just can't keep beating myself up and hating myself forever. I'm trying to be willful and just say, do this, you know, focus on this, shut up, be quiet. That mode of operating, that willful mode of operating, is not going to do me any good. It's not helpful, it's not skillful. I've got to start to be a bit more friendly and compassionate towards myself. You know, I've got to live with this thing. How can we be friends, you know? Yeah. So you come from a particular experience point, and sometimes the realizations aren't necessarily what you were looking for. You know, I was looking to get concentrated and realize nirvana and get out into those special states, and maybe the first realization that comes after a little while is, I don't know about that, but I know I've got to live with my mind, I better start being a bit more skillful and kind and recognize, you know, cooperative relationship with my mind, my body, what's going on around me. This is actually the process, the deepening process from points, states, things that we try to occupy ourselves with when we meditate, into something that opens into a field whereby you get a message of how you've got to operate right across the field, right across the whole area of your life, right across the attitudes, assumptions, intentions that you're making in your life. This is something that happens for people. Sometimes we don't necessarily even fully recognize it, but you're finding that by and large, as people meditate, they tend to get less violent, rather more violent. Tend to get less acquisitive, rather more acquisitive, thinking, no, I'd just like to live more simply. Tend to get more friendly and compassionate to each other, rather less friendly, you know. So the level of your life starts to change. And you're noticing things you were doing 5 years ago, 10 years ago. No, I don't want that anymore. So this is the development is really in terms of levels, and states are there to just help to kind of push or to prime or to get us to the point, yeah, when really seeing the way our mind is and what's the message that we get, how can I live with this? And so you start to integrate to another level of being. This is the whole real educative process of meditation. I would say that any state you experience in meditation is only as good as your ability to integrate it. If it's just a flash, so what? You know, it's just a trophy on the wall, you know. This day I finally hit silence. You stick it, you know, you put it on the calendar. Well, so what? You know, it's just another thing that happened, came and went. So what? States, and you can spend the next 10 years trying to get back to that state again. You know, I had that great state in my last retreat. I want to get back to it again. This is the way in which nothing really deep has been learned. We haven't integrated it. Yeah. It's just become another possession, another accumulation, another thing to grab hold of, another thing to identify with, to add to one's, you know, library, to one's sense of accomplishments, and eventually, so what? Comes and goes. But it's not that states aren't useful, but they're as useful as one's ability to listen to it, to get what it's telling you about your attitudes and assumptions, and to integrate that. So if your mind becomes just that sense of a little more quiet, or just the ability to step back from the thoughts and recognize thoughts come and go and they're not necessarily to be believed in. You know, you'd hear all these thoughts running through your mind, and you just sit with that. Do you really want to believe in all this as some abiding truth? Or isn't it more important not to how to relate to the thought, what the thought is trying to tell you? I am angry, I'm upset, I am excited. And then the real integration is how do I relate to that? How am I with that experience? And then we have learned something. We've learned, you know, something that's going to take you, gives you wisdom that then transfers into the whole field of your life. The sense of being able to step back and contemplate thoughts, emotions, feelings, inspiration, desperation, hatred, jealousy, fear, joy. How do I relate to this? This is really an important point, because it sometimes gets missed in the search for states. You think, you know, the question to poise is, what is the beginning of the Buddha's teaching? What is the real beginning of the Buddha's teaching? Is it suffering? Is it, what is it? His teaching. So he had these experiences, you know, he got some states or some experiences, and then arising from that begin to recollect the whole field of cause and effect and conditionality within which experience is manifest in this tremendously profound teaching of dependent origination. So he's getting this realization of the wholeness of experience, and then now what? You know? And then according to the way it's presented in the teaching, the Brahma Sahampati, which is this name for a divine presence or a sublime presence which oversees the entire universe, and you can, you know, do what you like with that. It's a kind of mythic expression. Some sense of vastness opens up in him, and he experiences empathy, complete empathy, called anukampa, empathy, a sense of all beings, you know, great and small, are in this process of cause and effect conditions, that, and all beings are subject to death, suffering. And then from that sense of empathy, probably not seeming to know what to teach, in fact, but having this feeling of, there is something I must respond to, I must say something, I must respond to the world. And then starting to walk towards the people he felt he could most, would probably give him ear, would listen to him. And then, you know, after 6 weeks of walking, comes to the deer park, meets his former friends and says, what you're doing, this ascetic stuff, this is pointless. You know, you should not be following this way of extremes. Yeah. And then he begins to teach the truth of suffering and the middle path and the ceasing of suffering and so forth. So that's the way he expressed it, but where did that come from? The sense of empathy, the sense of relatedness. And getting that sense of relatedness and empathy, then I must say something. And you can tell that in the story, the first thing he said to met somebody on the path when he was walking to Benares, and he started telling this person, well, I'm a Buddha, I'm an enlightened one, and nobody knows more than me. And the man said, well, good, and wandered off, you know, because it was true, but it wasn't a teaching. So the Buddha obviously didn't know the Four Noble Truths, or didn't have them configured as what to present. But he did have the sense of empathy. So it doesn't really begin with the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, it begins with a sense of compassion, empathy, understanding, conditionality, yeah, and connectedness. And then from there until the last moment of his life, right to his lying on his deathbed, dying of colic and dysentery. So, you know, you can imagine that state, weakened, still saying, has anybody got any questions? I mean, this is a tough act to follow. Right? So the last one says, please don't hesitate, because I haven't got much longer to live. Anybody got any questions? You're too bashful to ask somebody else to ask for you. I mean, this person was not holding back, you know. What compassion, what a sense of sharing. This person had completely almost dissolved their sense of identity into this great outreaching of compassion and the clarity of what he could offer. Yeah. This is so just to recollect that, to remember it. Remember, this actually is what we are, those of us who hear the Dhamma. You will have heard it in various forms. You're all inheritors of that gesture, that tremendous gesture of the Buddha. Yeah. And everyone, every teacher who's come along since then has done that. You know, whatever they got, they try and do that. This is the gesture of the Buddha Dhamma. It's not a technique. Techniques, systems can help you, but essentially it's coming to that gesture and living out that gesture. Is the perhaps the, you know, the simplest way to express the integration of the Dhamma, integration of our meditation, our recollections, our cultivations of Dhamma. It integrates into that, into awareness of the field, and movement into the field of presence, into the field of being, into the field of conditionality, with compassion, with clarity, and without holding on. Now we take that, you know, as our model, rather than how can I focus on the breath. Focusing on the breath. I do that. But you see, this is a particular detail, a point. Particular point I can do sometimes, or try to do sometimes. But actually, getting the perspective right, rather than, you know, how can I get more time to do that thing? Looking at how can I integrate, how can I bring the Dhamma up, you know, into my life, rather than how can I kind of sort of get rid of all these irritating people and things and get down to this one point. Because as far as I've recognised it, as soon as you get rid of one irritating set of circumstances, another one starts. Something else to get involved with, caught up with, or, you know, fascinated by, or attached to. So it's like, instead of, you know, how can you cut it all out? How can you cut it out? How else? So you get down to this really refined point, cut it all out. You know, where's that going? Where does that direction go? So now you've got to cut your own mind out. Your thinking mind's got to go out. You know, friends and relatives, they've got to go. Cut it all out. Says I can. Well, what's the point, you know, of that? What about turning it the other way around? How could I open it all out so that the real problem is just this self-grasping, what's called the upadana, the sense of that which wants to contract and hold on. It's not a person. It's the experience that we all have. It's not a person's fault, it's not a person's problem, it's the experience that we all have that comes into the mind, and it generates the sense of self. It generates, you know. So the attachment comes first, the holding comes first, from this confusion, from desire, from wanting to find, to be, to have, to get rid of. This kind of restless, where's the bit that I can get, and, you know, and then we become, in accordance with what the mind is holding on to. It's called upadana, taking as a support. It's a contraction of the mind, a contraction of this span of awareness into a particular object of some kind. That we feel is going to make us feel good. And there are the four bases of that. One is the sense realm. So if you just find the taste, the feel-good taste, the feel-good sight, sound, touch, music, thoughts, whatever, something I can actually have this experience that can make me feel good. And there are those, as we all know. Sight, sound, touch can make us feel really good for a while. And then we'll have a little more for another one. It's just that, there's nothing, you know, that's just what all it can do. It doesn't mean you've got to despise it or hate it, just recognizing that's about what all the sense realm can really do for you is give you moments, passages of feeling good, and then it's going to pass. Along with that, some of them feel rather unpleasant. There are unpleasant sights, sounds, distressing thought things to think about. So it's a very mixed bag. But it always comes around with that sense of something we can hold on to, get. And you can see that in this, this is a feature that we human beings have developed to a great degree. There's an enormous amount of stuff we can now get, switch on, plug in, and seeming never-ending possibilities of new ones on the same themes. It's always going to be sights, sounds, thoughts, touches, faster, quicker, newer, and then next year, the next development of it. Next, another thing that causes this contraction is the sense of time of getting somewhere. I like to feel I'm getting somewhere. I'm developing, I'm progressing. Don't like to feel I'm not progressing. So you want to progress in something. Learn something, cultivate something, get somewhere. You know, in meditation or in study or whatever. And of course we can do this. We can certainly get places, we can get promoted, we can get fit, we can win races, we can become famous or whatever. You know, we get somewhere, and you know, wherever you get to, it'd be nice to get a bit further in it. When is it enough? You see, these, and then meanwhile, your ability to progress starts to fade. You know. As you age, you can't quite get the energy together, the mind isn't so focused, the faculties get dimmer. So you feel you're failing or you're degenerating. So the progress will always going to be some sense of not quite getting enough, competition with others, seeing disappointment if I don't get it. And then even if I do get it, still not enough, and then eventually losing it. So that's all that can do, really. And you notice how much we feel identified with or experience the identity around our ability to get somewhere. And meditation is maybe one of the most annoying experiences for that kind of attitude. Frustrating experiences, because you go on these intensive retreats and really, you know, rev up to get somewhere on the retreat. And maybe, you know, you do get somewhere, but then the teacher says, yeah, well, more practice is necessary, and you know, keep going. And then you come out of the retreat and you have got somewhere, but then it's back to your life and so forth, and the first argument with your spouse or partner, and then you realize you haven't got anywhere. Or it's gone, and you've got to wait till next year to get back and do another session of getting somewhere. And then, will somebody tell me where I've got to? What stage am I at? And you get these kinds of jnanas and knowledges and insight realizations and stream enterer or whatever it is, these kind of things one looking for. But you feel the energy of it, of that trying to get somewhere. And what we have to leave out. What we have to sort of repress or push aside to keep our feeling of being, you know, having got somewhere. Another big one that the mind contracts around is opinions and views. This is a great one, a rather awful one actually. When you recognize the amount of quarrelling and conflict and actually direct murder that goes on around opinions and views. You know, get a particular conviction, an ideology, a religion, something you believe in, and when you believe in something, you feel empowered by it, you feel psyched up, you feel energized by it, you're right, this is absolutely true and right, and I'm prepared to die for that, and I'm prepared to, you know, kill somebody else for it if need be. You know. And these people have been doing this for the time of a memorial. You know, the various wars in the name of gods and religions and beliefs and ideologies and so on. You know. What does it do? It's rather like it's even more powerful perhaps than the hit we get from a sense object. It's like a powerful drug, like taking cocaine, when you get the feeling of being right and having a strong conviction and feeling empowered by it. Something that lights up. Yeah. And the terrible things that go on through that righteousness. The stain of religion, the bane of it. The last one is the sense of ourself, which it becomes something we that the mind will keeps fussing around. How am I? What will I be? Where will I go? What will happen to me when I pass away? And so forth. You know, what am I? Who am I? Where am I? What's it about? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Why was I born? What happens when I die? Will I die? You know, almost immediately one thinks of oneself as a discrete, separate object. This contraction occurs, and pretty soon suffering starts coming along behind it. So with all of these forms of clinging, or upadana, grasping, There's an energy that first of all feels empowering or gladdening or exciting, enticing, the feeling of progress, the feeling of conviction, something we can really get and have. And that's the first thing that gets us in there, gets the mind in there. What comes up afterwards, at the end of it, is stress and suffering. And in the middle of that process, the really significant thing that perhaps we don't often recollect is as the grasping, as the clinging increases, what decreases is the empathy. Yeah. So, you know, you see something like, I don't know if you have sales, for example, Christmas sales or New Year's sales, when all the shops are open and everybody's, you know, suddenly it's a big sale. And there's people fighting each other, jumping over each other to get the goods, you know, elbowing each other out of the way to get the bargain, you know. Like, you know, whenever this sense of getting something occurs, our sense of communality, cooperative, empathic sense decreases. You see that, you know, they're so, you know, we see, say for example, with views and opinions, you get something like a strong religious view or a political view, like Nazism, for example. You know, when you feel really, you know, these are the Nazism and a strong feeling of the right, the pure, the pure race, the rule of the true law, and we can see the results of that. The empathy is cut. So you can do terrible things to other people, and that's a very clear example. It's not the only example by any means. Look at the Cambodian genocide, which was aimed at purifying the society. Somebody got some ideas, Pol Pot and his friends got some ideas for how to wipe out this kind of messy, westernized thing that was taking over Cambodia, start afresh. Let's get clear and start afresh. That sounds like quite a good idea, doesn't it? Let's kind of get all this corrupt stuff and get back to a really pure way of living. Same as the Nazis, let's live pure. Yeah. We just get this kind of messy stuff tidied up, you know? And you take that as a conviction. Look at the results. It's sort of like a third of the population of the country brutally murdered. How does it happen? You know, how can people do this to each other? I don't know how, but I know they do. Yeah. It's part of the thing that one is shocked, but actually has to acknowledge this is capable. Us human beings are capable of doing this, definitely. Yeah. And then see, how does it happen? Well, it happens through the loss of empathy, losing that sense of connection to a field of other beings. We do it to animals all the time. Yeah. We do it to the planet all the time. Getting my own, forget these other creatures who don't really count. Getting what we need, forget the forest, they don't really count. Forget the earth, we just get what we want. So we do this, this happens for human beings all the time. And surely if there's any real development that is not just a religious idea or an interesting meditation experience or a bit of spiritual, you know, glitter, it must be widening, deepening and living out our potential for empathy. What else could be for our own welfare, for the welfare of others, and lead us to peace? What else would do that? It's impossible, I'm saying this, but just think it through, surely isn't it impossible to live life purely for one's own welfare? That just does not happen. Yeah. It's only, you know, because if you have that attitude, you're going to be a miser, you're going to be a tyrant, you're going to be a megalomaniac, an egomaniac, obsessed with yourself, and so on. This is what, if we just have that attitude, that's the direction it goes in. And human beings do have that attitude, and that's where it takes them to. Is it really for our welfare? So that's the point of the ignorance in our mind. We do get that feeling of empowerment, of gratification, of feeling high when we get what we want for a moment. But then you've got to keep increasing it. And think, oh yeah, well I can have a little bit more. More power. More influence. More this, more that. Yeah. And what isn't being noticed is the loss of empathy, sharing. Now, what the religious teachers teach, true spiritual teachers teach, Buddha, Jesus, right across the board, any true spiritual teaching saying, for my welfare, for your welfare, for the welfare of both, this is where it actually works. This will definitely make me feel happier. Yeah. It won't be that same sort of glorified, empowered, luminous qualities that we get from getting my own way, but it will be a different kind of happiness, of contentment, of fearlessness, of release, of not having enemies, of sympathy, of having a great heart. Yeah. And that great heart will be with me through my pain and my death. And so that we'll pass through, we'll have learnt what this life can teach us, and we'll pass through these inevitable gateways of aging, sickness and death. We'll pass through them freely and with a sense of release and joy rather than misery and despair. And meanwhile, while we're in this passage, our lives will be touched and enriched by love, compassion, appreciation of others. And it's equanimity, the ability to hold this strange world of sorrow, joy, happiness, unhappiness, good and evil in balance. The quality of upekkha. So the empathic sense then is the basis for what we know. I'm sure you all know the Brahma Vihara, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. I don't need, I haven't really got the time to go into all those, and I'm sure you're fully aware of that. But just to bear in mind, you know, these are the qualities that the heart brings forth when we really begin to orient ourselves on the empathic level. When we're with others, even when we're alone. You know, like my first lesson, better start to be nice to myself. You know, better stop being so willful and brutal to myself. You know, better start just finding how to, you know, ease into what I'm doing, rather than this feeling I'm going to get there, knock it out, get enlightened in 3 weeks, and here we go, you know. Sounds like a good idea. Why hang around? You know? So the beauty of the empathic sense is that, yes, it's of course it's for everyone, but even when you're on your own, you realise one of the object that you most need to continue to have empathy for and is what your own body-mind experience, whether that's, you know. And empathy for it means just that, how am I with this? So whatever's happening, sickness, joy, problems, things we have to do, things that are kind of challenging us, is the topic, is the object, is the point. And our unenlightened tendency will say, well, how do I get over this? How do I get this? How do I stop this happening? What can I find in this? And why is this happening to me? You know, it's not my, who, you know, that kind of thing. And these are the basis of clinging, the me sense, the getting somewhere sense, the wanting to find, have something, and so forth. And then instead of following that unawakened tendency, our practice is, how am I with this? How am I with this sense of being a bit of a failure, not having made it? Yeah. How am I with this? What will support me to be with this experience? What will help me to be with this experience of having done things wrong, or being a failure, or making mistakes? Well, only one answer, isn't there, really? But it's not just the thought, you know, I should be kind. It's actually when you touch into what's holding you, and instead of thinking it, you may indeed start with the thought of it, as generally we do. Our cognitive sense, you know, conjures up the problems, or she's such a nuisance, and what am I going to do about him, and it's all his fault, and so forth. Or it's all my fault, I'm stupid, and it goes into these things. Pause, widen. What's the feeling with that? Jealousy, disappointment, anger, you know, competitiveness. What's the feeling with that? And then, how are you with that feeling? Feeling of threatened or whatever it is. How are you with that? Rather than trying to fix it, solve it, blame it, get rid of it, decide whose fault it is, figure out how you should be or shouldn't be. You shouldn't be experiencing this feeling after all. Cheer up, get over it, be nice. Rather than doing all that stuff, well, how are you with this? Yeah. And maybe there is a verbal answer, but what you're doing with the question is, instead of adding to the topic, or moving away from the topic, or fixing the topic, or deciding where it came from, you're staying with it, staying with the experience of that, what we call dukkha, the incomplete, the irresolute, the thing that's getting us, and we're widening, softening into an empathic relationship with whatever is holding us. An empathic relationship with it. This actually is the nub of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. Suffering is to be understood, and it's not understood conceptually. It's you widen around it, you stand under it, you open to it, you hold it, and from that this almost an involuntary natural response comes up of empathy. Now, as you all know, I hope, whenever we're in trouble or difficulty, what is the thing that most of us will do or want to do? Find someone to talk to. If you can't shove it down or fix it, what's the next thing? Find someone to talk to. Yeah. If you hear somebody's in trouble, what's the response that, you know, right across the field human beings will do? I'll go and listen to him. I'll go and help her out. I'll stop by. I'll phone her up. Yeah. I'll go for a walk. We'll just do some cooking together. Anything, you know, just be with it. Yeah. There's nothing specifically, you know, patented religion about that. It's just human. That something in us at a level when we feel it, I can't change it, I can't fix it, I haven't got an answer for it. I'm not going to keep blaming for it, anybody about it. I'm just going to... What happens is you empathize. You find that need for empathy, the need to share, to widen beyond your sense of self, from that kind of into something more shared, is the natural human response right across the planet. Everybody does that. And if you do that, oh yeah, it helps. Isn't it strange? You know, you go for a hike. If there's five of you walking up a mountain, struggling, having difficulties, it's a lot easier than when you're on your own. When people are sick and dying, come and see them, sit with them, be there. This is the universal teaching, the universal response, the universal naturalness. It means open the field of empathy. And in that, we're helping to hold each other's suffering. And just holding suffering, not clamping around it, not constricting around it, just holding it in this loving, empathic way. This is how the origin, the craving and the grasping relinquishes it, is relinquished, and we experience a sense of release. This is the possibility for us. Meditation, of course, is one avenue, one doorway, one perhaps, you know, focused time to do that, where you just sit down, and because you're not, or trying to avoid distracting, you keep trying to just really get down to that point. And but the point is not the point. The point is, can any point that you arrive at, anywhere you arrive at, can that allow you, can that encourage you to open into a field of empathy? So that your suffering is a strong word, but your feeling of incompleteness, irresolute, not certain, where am I, who am I, where's it going, that kind of nagging, Oh, who's that? Calm. And in that field of empathy, there's a letting go. We realize we don't have to be anybody. We don't have to get anywhere. It's a kind of silly idea, really. Where's anybody getting to? 6 feet under, that's what we're getting to. Everybody gets there. Why hurry, you know? But, well, looking at not is more like, rather than a movement in time towards some point in the future, we're looking at widening the conscious space in the here and now, from the constricted point to the widened field. Now that is a development. Yeah. It doesn't take 10 years. It might take 10 years to recognize this is what we've got to do. Actually, you can do that in a moment when you hear somebody else is suffering. You go, oh, it suddenly opens up by itself. Yeah. If you just respond naturally from the heart. Now this is the way we are. And the Buddha teaching, really, human beings touching into the way we actually are. What's going to help us? What's going to support us? We can't help that. We are naturally empathic. And the unfortunate thing is that some of our developments, so-called developments, have been that which complicate us and distract us and fabricate us into personal forms that we lose touch with our natural, simple grace that we have. Meditation is, if Dhamma practice is anything, really, in the long term, isn't it about a simplification and a returning to something we already have, already present? How can it be calming and peaceful if it's a matter of reaching up for something? How could it be calming and peaceful? Unless it's this sense of widening and deepening into what is present for us, but we lose touch with it. So this is the... Because as Buddhas know, and as we study or consider or think or begin to recognize all that we are, and even the term we are is a bit of a wrong view, is this coming together of cause and effect, of causes and conditions. This very body is more like somebody said it's like a coral reef. There's so many different microorganisms and things operating within it, you can't really claim any of it. It's causes and conditions, chromosomes and genes, mitochondria and microorganisms all just gathering together in this thing called a body. Yeah. This mind is the causes and conditions of our memories, our thoughts, our social conditioning, our fears and joys and happiness and so forth. So we are this web of causes and conditions. You try and find a point in it you can hold on to, and you just get into that place where we strengthen our own ability to suffer. And we have an enormous capacity for that, and almost tireless energy to do so. There's never a moment in the day when you're too tired to suffer. You always got time for that. Because that contraction is this, the wrong response. So we come down just that wrong response. Yeah. So this is simplify, widen, soften. This is really this gesture. This is what helps ourselves. Just consider even like planetary life. We all recognize the environmental crisis we're in, and there's a huge topic there that I don't have the time to talk into. But just imagine like cooperation, generosity, sharing, simplification of our lives. Respect for other creatures, a real sense of belonging to the web, and regarding that as much more important than my own little bit. Wouldn't that be a big part of the solution? Perhaps the only way this thing is ever going to get turned around. Mm. So you can see, just from the very kind of large global sense to the very simple personal sense, this is essentially the movement, you know, that turns the aspirant, the yogi, into the Buddha, turns the meditation practice into the Dhamma, turns our sense of who we are into the place of sharing. So I offer this for your reflection tonight, and I'd like to pause a little bit. We have some time for questions, but first of all I just would like to express my warmth and appreciation of your attention. You've listened to me for quite a while, and so thank you very much for listening, for sending, letting me occupy your minds for a few moments, and I'm very pleased to be here. Unfortunately, it's just one of those flash visits, but hopefully we can make something worthwhile out of it. So is anybody have anything they'd like to ask about or bring up? Yeah, gentleman in the back. What has meditation got to do with all this? Well, there's, of course, you know. Well, meditation, you know, there's a number of words you can use for that, but we'd probably all recognize that mindfulness is a part of it. Bearing something in mind, staying with something long enough to really be able to review it, yeah. And samadhi or collectedness is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. It's part of meditation. So these seem to be, first of all, about holding to a particular point. And they are. But you focus on a particular point, like your breathing or your body or something like that, you begin to experience that point itself is not a point. It's a series of causes and effects that keep arising and passing. And as you begin to practice that, you also realize that, you know, holding your mind to one point is not as simple as it sounds. It's not a matter of just willfully clamping. It requires a whole series of a field, in fact, of things such as kindness, encouragement, balancing energy, relinquishment, renunciation of other distracting thoughts. So it's really a mind field that you cultivate as you meditate. It's not just that holding onto a point, it's about cultivating a whole field, a mental field that links, comes together around one theme. Yeah. And the object that you're focusing on itself, though it starts out seeming like a point, is also experienced as a, you know, a point can be like the hole that you're looking at things through. What you experience, for example, when you experience breathing is a whole ongoing flow of sensations, energies, subtle signs. So it's a mind field contemplating a body field is what meditation is about. And so as you do that, you begin to, I imagine, recognize that the potency in that is that which encourages us to develop, or encourages the ongoing development of relinquishment, of kindness, of clarity. And those are the qualities that then begin to integrate into your life. One of the most important points in meditation is the time when you come out of it. So if you're just hitting the bell, it's important not to jump out of meditation, but to actually just stay centered and gradually open the senses. So it helps the integration process to take place. one of the problems with meditation is when you get the feeling it is something completely separate. You come out, you've left it all behind. If you've come out of meditation, you may very well have left behind the important thing that you're supposed to carry with you, which is the quality of, you know, the mind state you're in, the attitudes that seem important at this particular time, and then you try to bring that into the widening field of awareness that happens when the sense doors open. There's a widening field, and you try to sustain those qualities through the wider field. So, you know, going from sitting, eyes closed, standing, walking, you know, integrating all that, so it becomes the common theme under it all is qualities of goodwill, of clarity, of relinquishment of what's unnecessary, purification. And that spreads through the whole field of experience. Yes?
Can you talk more about that integration process? Is it an active process, a passive process, similar?
It's a receptive process. It's not exactly active that you say now I'm doing my integration, you know. Nor is it passive, it's receptive. It means listening in, you know, listening in and picking up the tones. I say tones, I'm not sounds, I mean the mental attitudes. And so this is what reflection is about, reflection and recollection. Reflection means so how am I with this? It's like a thought, an emotion, a sensation, an attitude, a scenario, a project. How am I with this? That's reflection. You're looking into the mirror. You hold that thing there and you, what's it telling me? Well, I'm feeling a little bit impatient. No, that's not good. Because the meditation helps to polish the mirror. You know, it's a mirror polisher, and then as you come out of the meditation or even in the meditation, you begin to notice what attitudes and energies are not supportive, not helpful, not necessary, and even conducive to stress. Well, let's just let go on that one. And what attitudes are supportive, helpful, conducive? Let's just potentize and tune in to that one. So wise reflection, Buddha's word yoniso manasikara, wise reflection is the essential integrator. Yeah. So it's something you bring into meditation, also you bring it into everything you do. Giving my attention to this particular topic, what's it doing to me? When I have these sort of attitudes and intentions in mind, how does that feel? When I regard this person in this way, how does that feel? Is this doing me any good? If I start comparing myself with him or her, how does that feel? Stressful. Why don't I stop doing it? Why don't I just say, whoever you are, fine, you know? And so you start to see things like that, the comparing mind, the got to get there mind, the fault finding mind. Does it do me any good? No. Does it do anybody else any good? No. Why don't you stop doing it then? It's not always so easy, but when you begin to feel that kind of the it's like what the meditation does, it begins to tune you into the almost like a somatic gripping in the nervous system. So it's not just the ideology of be nice person, but you feel this gripping, constricting, tensing up somewhere in your gut or in your nerves, and I think I can just soften and widen and just relax a little bit around that one. And you get change. So the meditation polishes the mirror. Wise reflection is asking the question, is this conducive to my welfare, anybody else's welfare? And so once that, you realize, no, then come back. And the empathy is the quality that then gets us in touch with this unnecessary stress that's happening in our minds, nervous system, our guts, our hearts. Oh dear. Oh, that's tough. Let's just relax on that one. Yeah, that's the process. That's how it integrates. And it's kind of the most trivial things. Some of those kind of embarrassingly trivial things, like petty jealousies. She got one of those, I didn't. She thinks she's so good. Who does she think she is? Oh God, I hate that voice in my mind. No, that isn't doing. Hating it isn't going to work. Notice that voice in your mind that starts to snipe at somebody else. Stay with that. Ugh. Stay with that. Relax, pause. You really got to learn it almost from the gut level upwards. Because we all know how we should be, probably. But we're not, are we? Yeah. Is that a question? Somebody else? Oh, sorry, yeah.
When the meditator begins to notice the subtleties of the self-grasping, should effort be applied? Should it not be applied? What would be the next thing?
Well, effort, of course, is a many-faceted word. Get interested in it, I would say. So it's energy, yeah. But the effort is not to push it away or to make more of it or to make less of it or to blame anything. The effort is just become more interested. So that's a kind of energizing. Let's call it potentizes. Get interested in and then bring out the effort of Dhamma Vijaya, investigation. What really is this about? There's all kinds of stories that we can say about it, but what can we get it down to just the one term? Because the shorter the story is, the more accurate it is. It's just, generally the story is pain. It always comes down to one word, really. Like the pain of being frustrated, the pain of being hurt, the pain of being inadequate, whatever it is. What's the answer to pain? The answer to pain is, ah. It's all wordless, but then the effort, the energy is just to stay with, to get interested, to gently inquire, and to allow yourself to feel it, and then it will. You can't do release. You can only get to the point where release happens by itself. And it's marvellous and it's beautiful that release can happen. We should never claim it as our own. It's a marvellous grace that comes to us in our state of crisis. If we stop wriggling and resisting it. Yeah. Line between
sort of where I can where I should be totally open and when I need to set that firm boundary where I don't appear so open.
Yeah. Well, totally open is probably generally to be avoided. Because it's gonna get shredded. So it's finding the appropriate bit that you can actually manage, that you can wrap around, realizing it's this, that we're in a hologram. So that if you get the appropriate focus of attention of stuff that you can actually process, either in your speech, your life, your livelihood, or in your mind, that you can deal with, then you are dealing with, you know, your aspect of the whole hologram, which is compounded of greed, hatred, delusion. So anytime you're working on that, even it's just when you're meditating, you're still working on welfare of the world. And you set the boundary really at how much you can, what is the amount you can digest. So it's, you know, for example, it's actually quite traumatizing if you take in too much stuff, too much of the problems that go on. And this is a real issue because we do feel we need to be informed. But then if you're informed of, I mean, you just get this state where you feel, what's the point of doing anything apart from, you know, jumping off a cliff? So too much overload that you can't digest and process has a traumatizing effect. So you're going to think, yeah, okay, is this now what? So if you like, there's the global reference, but the action is local. And local, it's up to you to decide how wide your boundaries are. But the theme of it is it's that which you can cope with, manage with, in your own ability to respond and act and receive and empathize with. And that boundary may change, you know, day to day, from year to year, time to time. So you try to find that. That's the, you know, how to stay joyful. To stay joyful is an act of tremendous courage. Straight, you know, joyful, and it's a tremendous contribution. You look at someone like Dalai Lama. What reason does he have to feel joyful? You know, it's looking at what's happened to his country and his situation, and yet being able to somehow process that through compassion. And you see, the net result is a person who's met and seen and heard a huge amount of suffering, and yet is able to remain joyful and compassionate. He said, you know. So now, you know, we can't always get that big to manage that much. What can I manage? Still, so the sign of it is still there is the ability to feel the joyfulness, the gratitude, the causes and conditions that have brought me here, the recognition of my mortality, I'm not too important to myself, and a sense of empathy. And where does all that happen? Where does all that crystallize? Where does all constellate in terms of my daily life? That's your riddle. That's your bit. But those are the signs to look out for. Thank you. With me? Time to wrap up, is it? Okay.